We are now at the book of Judges, chapter 11, and the only portion of the book that we have not studied is chapters 11 through 16, which is six chapters. We studied chapters 17 through 21 earlier in the week, so we just have this segment to fill in. These are two stories in these six chapters, the story of Jephthah and the story of Samson, and those apparently are the last, not the last two judges, because there were a couple of judges between Jephthah and Samson, but the last two major judges, of which we know very much. Jephthah is an interesting story, in some ways kind of an attractive figure, in that he was kind of an outlaw for justice, or, you know, kind of a Robin Hood type, it would seem. But he was the illegitimate son, and should use caution in using that term, because whenever there's what is ordinarily called an illegitimate child, it's really the parents who were illegitimate rather than the child. But he was the child of a prostitute. Gilead was the name of his father, and the people of Gilead were the descendants of this man. And Gilead had other sons also, and they didn't like Jephthah because he was not a legitimate son through a legal wife. And so they thrust him from their presence and did not wish for him to have any part of the inheritance of their father with him. And he became sort of a brigand, an outlaw leader out in the wilderness. And what he did exactly during that time, we don't know, but it says that vain men gathered unto him, probably outlaws. Might be the same kind of group that later grouped together with David when he was fleeing from Saul. And he became a leader of them, and later his own brothers approached him to deliver them from the oppression of Ammon, of which we read in the previous chapter. In chapter 10, verse 15, it says, "The children of Israel said unto the Lord, We have sinned. Do thou unto us whatsoever seemeth good unto thee. Deliver us only, we pray thee, this day. And they put away the strange gods from among them and served the Lord, and his soul was grieved for the misery of Israel. Then the children of Ammon were gathered together and encamped in Gilead." Now, Gilead is, of course, the town, the community named after Jephthah's father. And the children of Israel assembled themselves together and encamped in Mizpah, which also is associated with Jephthah. It became his hometown when he was thrust out of Gilead. "And the people and princes of Gilead said one to another, What man is he that will begin to fight against the children of Ammon? He shall be head over all the inhabitants of Gilead." Now, before we're introduced to Jephthah by name, we find that his brethren of the people of Gilead, who had thrust him out, were beginning to talk among themselves, saying, now which of us is really going to be able to rally the troops to drive out the Ammonites? And they must have realized that none of them were brave enough or strong enough to do this, but they did have a half-brother whom they had rejected, named Jephthah, who's living out in the wilderness, and he's the one they sought to. It says, "Now Jephthah, the Gileadite, was a mighty man of valor, and he was the son of a harlot, and Gilead begat Jephthah. And Gilead's wife bare him sons, and his wife's sons grew up, and they thrust out Jephthah, and said unto him, Thou shalt not inherit our father's house, for thou art the son of a strange woman. Then Jephthah fled from his brethren, and dwelt in the land of Tob. And there were gathered vain men to Jephthah, and went out with him. And it came to pass in the process of time that the children of Ammon made war against Israel, and it was so that when the children of Ammon made war against Israel, the elders of Gilead went to fetch Jephthah out of the land of Tob. And they said unto Jephthah, Come, be our captain, that we may fight with the children of Ammon. And Jephthah said unto the elders of Gilead, Did ye not hate me, and expel me out of my father's house? And why are ye now come to me when you are in distress? And the elders of Gilead said unto Jephthah, Therefore we turn again to thee now, that thou mayest go with us and fight against the children of Ammon, and be our head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. And Jephthah said unto the elders of Gilead, If you bring me home again to fight against the children of Ammon, And the Lord delivered them before me. Shall I be your head? They had suggested that in the previous verse. We want you to come fight with us and then be our head. That is, of course, be the judge at that time. And he says, oh, is that really what you're going to do? You're going to really let me be the leader if I win this one? And the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, the Lord be witness between us if we do not sow according to thy words. In other words, we don't know how to assure you any more than just to say the Lord is the witness that we've said this, and may he judge us if we don't keep our promise. Then Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head of the and captain over them. And Jephthah uttered all his words before the Lord in Mizpah. Mizpah is apparently where his house was at this time, because there's a mention of his return to Mizpah when his daughter came out to meet him at the end of the story. And Jephthah sent messengers unto the king of the children of Ammon, saying, what hast thou to do with me, that thou art come against me to fight in my land? Now, instead of just surprising the enemy like Gideon had and others had, he didn't go and assassinate the king of Ammon like Ehud had done. He decided to correspond with the oppressor and reason with him. It's interesting that he was apparently seeking a peaceful resolution, or maybe he was just trying to strike up a fight verbally, but it seems like he was trying to reason with him, because he said, why are you doing this to us? And the king of Ammon returned a message to Jephthah and said, because Israel took away my land, and they came up out of Egypt from Arnon even to Jabbok and unto Jordan. Now, therefore, restore these lands again peaceably. And Jephthah sent messengers again to the king of the children of Ammon and said, and this is a rather lengthy letter, and it turns out the king of Ammon didn't even pay any attention to it, even though apparently it took quite a lot of thought to write, because it's a lengthy letter he wrote explaining the Jews' history of how when they came out of Egypt and they were coming to Canaan, they did have to pass through lands that were inhabited by Ammon and Moab and Edom and also of the Amorites. And Sihon was the king of the Amorites that they had to pass through. Well, he points out that when they came through, they didn't take the land of Ammon, and they didn't take the land of Moab. Here, the Ammonite king is saying, why did you take my land? I'm taking it back. Please let me have it peaceably. In other words, don't resist me. And the message of Jephthah essentially is, we didn't take your land. The land we took actually belonged to King Sihon, the ruler of the Amorites, not the Ammonites. And therefore, you don't have any right to this land. And he essentially argues, we've been in it for 300 years. You've never claimed it was yours all that time. And now you come in here and say it's your land. And he says, in fact, it never was your land. And we conquered it by our God, he says to the king of Ammon. Our God gave it to us. And why don't you just keep the land that your God gives to you? And this isn't part of it. So he argues that the claim that the king of Ammon has on the land is not a genuine claim. That in fact, the Jews never did afflict the Moabites or the Ammonites or the Edomites or take any of their land. So he's saying there's a false charge you're giving and the land isn't yours, but the king of Ammon didn't listen. We'll go ahead and read the correspondence here. The king of the children of Ammon, well, verse 14, Jephthah sent messengers again to the king of the children of Ammon and said unto him, thus saith Jephthah, Israel took not away the land of Moab, nor the land of the children of Ammon. But when Israel came up from Egypt and walked through the wilderness of the Red Sea and came to Kadesh, then Israel sent messengers to the king of Edom, saying, let me, I pray thee, pass through thy land. But the king of Edom would not hearken thereto. And in like manner they sent unto the king of Moab, but he would not consent. And Israel abode in Kadesh. Then they went along through the wilderness and compassed the land of Edom. That is, they went around it instead of through it, since they didn't have permission to go through it. And the land of Moab. They didn't interfere. They didn't fight with them initially. They went around it. And they came by the east side of the land of Moab and pitched on the other side of Arnon, but came not within the border of Moab, for Arnon was on the border of Moab. And Israel sent messengers unto Sihon, the king of the Amorites, the king of Heshbon. And Israel said unto him, let us pass, we pray thee, through thy land into my place. But Sihon trusted not Israel to pass through his coasts. But Sihon gathered all his people together and pitched in Jahaz and fought against Israel. And the Lord God of Israel delivered Sihon and all his people into the hand of Israel, and they smote them. So Israel possessed all the land of the Amorites, the inhabitants of that country. And they possessed all the coasts of the Amorites, from Arnon even to Jabbok, and from the wilderness even to Jordan. So now the Lord God of Israel has dispossessed the Amorites, not the Ammonites, but the Amorites, from before his people Israel. And shouldest thou possess it? In other words, our God gave us this possession. It was not yours originally. It was the Amorites originally. You never have earned it. You've never conquered it. And therefore, it's ours. And now, art thou anything better than Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab? Did he ever strive against Israel, or did he ever fight against them? You remember Balak, the son of Zippor, the king of Moab, was the one who hired Balaam, the prophet, to curse Israel. But he didn't actually make war with Israel. He didn't go out and resist Israel. And he's saying, why should you do different than him? While Israel dwelt in Heshbon in her towns and in Aroer in her towns, in all the cities that be along the coasts of Arnon, 300 years. So he's saying, in the past 300 years, we've dwelt in this land, and no one has resisted us in that period of time and said it wasn't our land. Why, therefore, did you not recover them within that time? Or why didn't you ever claim at that time that this was your land for those three centuries? Wherefore, I have not sinned against thee, but thou doest me wrong to war against me. The Lord, the judge, be judged. That is, Jehovah, the judge, be judged this day between the children of Israel and the children of Ammon. Howbeit, the king of the children of Ammon hearken not unto the words of Jephthah, which he sent him. So war was, of course, going to happen. This is a case where the war is not described in any detail. In fact, practically one verse is all that we get to describe the war. More focus is given to Jephthah and the fact that he made a vow to the Lord before the battle, and his method of keeping the vow after the battle is basically what is focused on in the remaining part of the chapter. Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah, and he passed over Gilead and Manasseh, and passed over Mizpah of Gilead, and from Mizpah of Gilead he passed over unto the children of Ammon. And Jephthah vowed a vow unto the Lord, and said, if thou shalt without fail deliver the children of Ammon into mine hands, then it shall be that whosoever cometh forth of the doors of my house to meet me, when I return in peace from the children of Ammon, shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering. Now, this sounds like a stupid vow to make. And it certainly sounds like, when his daughter later came out of the house to meet him, that he was obligated to offer her up as a burnt offering. And there are many Christians who believe that's exactly what he did. There's some debate among Christians about this. In fact, there hasn't been a satisfactory resolution of that debate to date. There are many who believe he actually sacrificed his daughter as a burnt offering, because it specifically says he kept his vow. For instance, verse 39 says, and it came to pass at the end of 2 months that she returned unto her father, who did to her according to his vow, which he had vowed. So whatever he vowed to do, he did to her. And therefore, many feel like we must assume that he actually killed his daughter and offered her as a burnt sacrifice. Now, Jephthah is one of the men commended in Hebrews 11:32 as a man of great faith. And, of course, we know that not everyone who was a man of great faith did all good things. I mean, some of those men did some very bad things, like Samson is mentioned also in that list, and he wasn't all good either. And it's possible for a man who does some very wrong things to still be remembered for his faith. However, I'm not convinced at all that he offered his daughter as a sacrifice. And one thing that needs to be considered here is the wording of his vow. Look at the vow. At the end of verse 31, he says, when I return in peace from the children of Ammon, then it shall be that whatsoever cometh forth from the doors of my house to meet me, when I return in peace from the children of Ammon, shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering. Now, I have a marginal note in my Bible, and maybe you do too, at the word and I will offer it up. And there is a great dispute as to whether this word should be translated and, or whether it should be translated or. And apparently there is some ambiguity in the Hebrew word, and it can be seen either way. If we choose to translate it or, then we have him saying, whatever comes to the door, I will either dedicate it to the Lord forever, or I will offer it up as a burnt offering to the Lord. And this allows enough latitude and flexibility that if it was his daughter who came out of the house, or any other person, you know, one of his servants, or even his wife, presumably, he would dedicate that person to the Lord forever. And that was done sometimes. As you know from the end of the book of Leviticus, there's rules concerning how a person who's dedicated to the Lord should be, given to the Lord. And instead of sacrificing, right, they'd serve the Lord in Shiloh at the tabernacle. Samuel, for instance, was dedicated to the Lord in this way before he was even born. And how was that vow fulfilled that his mother made? He served the Lord in Shiloh all the days of his life. And even in the days of Samuel's sons, there were women who were serving in the tabernacle, because we find that Samuel's sons, who were corrupt, actually began to fornicate with the women who were serving in Shiloh. Apparently, it was customary on occasions, probably not very common, but there were some cases where people dedicated their sons or their daughters to the Lord forever, and that meant that they'd be separated unto the service of the Lord for the rest of their lives. And in saying, whatever comes forth to the doors of my house to meet me, when I return in peace, it says, it shall be the Lord's, or, which is a very possible translation, or I will offer it up for burnt offering, suggests that if it's a human that comes out, I will dedicate it to the Lord, in the sense that that person will become the Lord's and serve in Shiloh and be separated unto the Lord for the rest of their life, rather than them being married and having a family and an occupation and taking over my family business or whatever. Or, if it's an animal, and it would have to be a clean animal in this case, I will offer it as a burnt offering. Now, if that is truly how we should interpret it, and the Hebrew has that flexibility, then it removes the problem. Because it means then, when his daughter came out, he had really wished it wouldn't have been her. Although he had made a vow to the Lord, he had taken that risk. He certainly, when he made the vow, must have known that there's a good possibility that the first person or thing to come out of the house would be a person rather than an animal. I mean, in those days, people took their sheep right into their house, unless they were a shepherd and had too big a flock to do that. But some people had personal pets, sheep, and it's well known that in the Middle East, people had, where Americans often will have a dog as a house pet, people would have a lamb as a house pet or something. And it's possible that he thought an animal might be the first thing to walk out of his house when he came home. But he also, of course, knew there's a possibility it could be his wife or his daughter who would come out. And it's impossible to believe, at least for me to believe, that he would have made a vow that he would sacrifice as a burnt offering anything, regardless of whether it was human or not, because certainly there's very strong teaching in the law that would forbid the sacrificing of your children, the sacrificing of human sacrifices. Yet, of course, some people did that anyway. People who didn't care about the law did sacrifice their children sometimes, but I just don't believe that was Jephthah's case, and I don't think he... Yeah, it's just not necessary to believe that, since we know there were cases of people dedicating their children or themselves to the Lord to serve perpetually at Shiloh. I think that's more likely what he had in mind there. He kind of made a two-way vow. If it's a human being who comes out, they'll be dedicated to the Lord at Shiloh. If it's not a human being, they'll be offered as a burnt offering. And that can be read just that way at Judges 11:31. Anyway, so Jephthah passed over unto the children of Ammon to fight against them, and the Lord delivered them into his hands. And he smote them from Aroer, even till thou come to Minnith, even 20 cities, and unto the plain of the vineyards, with a very great slaughter. Thus the children of Ammon were subdued before the children of Israel. So in a verse and a half, we basically have the battle. No details, just that Jephthah won. And, of course, we know, because that's what the focus of the story is, that he now is obligated to keep his vow, because God delivered the enemy into his hand. And Jephthah came to Mizpah unto his house, and behold, his daughter came out to meet him with timbrels and with dances, and she was his only child, because he had neither son nor daughter. And it came to pass, when he saw her, that he tore his clothes, which is, of course, the Jewish way of showing remorse and chagrin, and said, Alas, my daughter, thou hast brought me very low, and thou art one of them that trouble me, for I have opened my mouth unto the Lord, and I cannot go back. And she was obviously a devout girl. She said unto him, My father, if you have opened your mouth to the Lord, do to me according to that which has proceeded out of your mouth, for as much as the Lord hath taken vengeance for thee of thine enemies, even of the children of Ammon. Very rarely would you find a child this submitted to her parents and to the Lord. She doesn't even know what it is that he vowed, but by his reaction, it was evident to her that it was something tragic. It was something, some tragedy that would involve her. And she says, well, you know, if you vow to the Lord, you've got to keep your vow. And after all, the Lord deserves for you to keep the vow because he delivered your enemies into your hands and you ought to do whatever you promised him. And so she was really committed to the Lord in her own heart. And she said unto her father, let this thing be done for me. Let me alone 2 months that I may go up and down upon the mountains and bewail my virginity, I and my fellows, that is her companions, not male fellows, but her, you know, her girlfriends. And he said, go, and he sent her away for 2 months, and she went with her companions and bewailed her virginity upon the mountains. Now, bewailing her virginity simply means that since she was still a virgin unmarried, and now let's assume she was going to be dedicated to the Lord at Shiloh rather than burnt as an offering. It means, of course, that she would never have the opportunity to marry, and she would remain a virgin forever. And for most women, that was considered to be, a misfortune. I mean, women considered that their fulfillment would be in being a mother and raising children and so forth, and she was not going to have that opportunity now. So her perpetual virginity seems to be what's bewailed. Notice it doesn't say that she's going to bewail her death as if she was going to be sacrificed, but rather her virginity, which seems to be really what the great tragedy was, is she's going to be consigned to perpetual virginity.
What does bewail mean, actually?
Bewail means to weep over it or to lament it, to basically, you know, express sorrow about it for a period of time. Like when a dead person would, when a person died, his family would lament them or would mourn for them. And that's sort of the same thought. She's not mourning over her death, but she's mourning over the fact that she will never have a family. And this is particularly a misfortune. And the reason that it's such a hard thing on Jephthah is that she's his only child, which means that since she can't ever have a family and he doesn't have any other children, his family line is going to end right there. He's not going to ever, his family will not be perpetuated in another generation. And that is, of course, considered the ultimate misfortune in biblical times, that a man would have no children to leave his inheritance to. So this seems to be really what's going on here, at least in my opinion. Those many think that Jephthah actually did sacrifice her. And it came to pass at the end of 2 months that she returned to her father, who did unto her according to his vow, which he had vowed, and she knew no man. Now, isn't that interesting? It doesn't say he did to her according to her vow and he sacrificed her, but he did according to her vow and she knew no man, and she remained a virgin. So again, it seems to be talking not about her being sacrificed, though many Bible scholars believe that she was. And she knew no man, and it was a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went yearly to lament the daughter of Jephthah. Now, you might have a marginal reference by the word lament. The word lament in the Hebrew can be translated talk to or talk with. In the margin of my Bible, it says it, and I've read it elsewhere also. There's an alternate reading. They went yearly to talk to her. Now, if that's the right translation, then clearly she wasn't put to death. She remained alive, and it means apparently it was customary for the daughters of Israel to go and talk to her at Shiloh. I mean, the only company she had. It was time she'd have visitors. And the daughter of Jephthah, the Gileadite, 4 days in a year. So 4 days out of the year, it seems like they went to visit her. And that seems to make more sense than to think that every year, you know, she's put to death and every year, 4 days out of the year, all the women were supposed to mourn for that. There are arguments. There's a long list of arguments on both sides of the question, whether he sacrificed her or not. But to me, you know, just from those two changes in the Hebrew, you know, where it says changing the and to or and changing the word lament to talk to, which are both legitimate substitutions, then, of course, it removes the whole suggestion that he sacrificed her at all, and rather that she just became like Samuel, dedicated to the Lord and serving the Lord at the sanctuary. And the greatest tragedy of the situation was not that she died, but that she never married and never had children. She was a virgin, so that she was unable to give her father any issue to carry on the family name. Okay, now we're not finished with Jephthah now. And the men of Ephraim gathered themselves together and went northward and said to Jephthah, "Wherefore passest thou over to fight against the Ammonites and didst not call us to go with thee? We will burn you and your house with fire." Now these are the same guys who got mad at Gideon because Gideon didn't call them first. As it turns out, Jephthah answers them and says, "I did call you and you didn't come, so I went and risked my neck without you." And then he made war with them and he killed 42,000 of them. So the Ephraimites, you know, their own bad temper got them in big trouble on this occasion. Remember when they came and complained to Gideon, "Why didn't you call us to go with you?" Gideon calmed them down with a word. Jephthah, however, was feeling kind of upset at this point. He was already a bit grieved over his daughter's situation. And now he didn't want to take any guff from these guys who were themselves in the wrong. And so when they came with their complaint, rather than putting them off with a calm word, he rebuked them and then he killed them. They said they were going to burn him and his house with fire, too. They came to him a little more heated than they had come to Gideon before. And Jephthah said unto them, "I and my people were at great strife with the children of Ammon. When I called you, you delivered me not out of their hands." So I did summon you folks, and you guys didn't come to the rescue. "And when I saw that you delivered me not, I put my life in my hands and passed over against the children of Ammon, and the Lord delivered them into my hand. Wherefore, then, are ye come up into me this day to fight against me?" Then Jephthah gathered together all the men of Gilead, which were the ones who had called him originally to be their leader, and fought with Ephraim. And the men of Gilead smote Ephraim because they said, "Ye are Gileadites, ye Gileadites are fugitives of Ephraim among the Ephraimites and among the Manassites." So the Ephraimites insulted the Gileadites and said, "You guys don't have any inheritance here. You're just fugitives who've taken up residence among us." And so the Gileadites took the passages of Jordan, again the fords where people would try to pass over to escape, before the Ephraimites. And it was so that when those Ephraimites, which were escaped, said, "Let me go over," that the men of Gilead said unto him, "Art thou an Ephraimite?" And if he said no, they said to him, "Say now Shibboleth." Now Shibboleth simply means river or brook in Hebrew. But the Ephraimites had a special speech, a special accent. They were unable to pronounce a SH sound. Sort of like Oriental people who learn English very frequently. They have difficulty pronouncing the L and the R correctly. In fact, they usually kind of exchange them. Where we in English would use an L, they often pronounce it as an R. And where we would say R, they often pronounce it as an L. And it's an interesting phenomenon. I don't know why the difficulty exists, but it seems to be almost universal among Orientals that they have difficulty with that letter. In Germany, I found that when Germans are learning English, they have great difficulty pronouncing the TH sound because they don't have a TH sound in their language. It's just a kind of sound that they don't know how to make. Their tongue has never been trained from youth to do it like ours is. And we take some things for granted, you know, that we have figured. But then they make some sounds that we have a hard time learning, like the umlaut O. I mean, that English-speaking people have a tremendous difficulty learning to make that sound the way the Germans do. And that's just the way it is with different languages. Well, the Ephraimites spoke the same language as the rest of the Jews, but they had a tribal accent where they couldn't really pronounce the SH sound. So the Ephraimites, when they were smiting, the Gileadites under Jephthah, when they were smiting the Ephraimites, were chasing them, and the Ephraimites were running to escape over Jordan. So Jephthah positioned his men at the fords of Jordan where they would try to cross. And when the Ephraimites tried to cross, they said, "Are you an Ephraimite?" And of course they would say no, because that would be their death if they admitted that they were. So he said, "Well, we'll see if you are or not. Say Shibboleth." And if they were an Ephraimite, it says, "Then said they unto him, now say Shibboleth." And he said Sibboleth, because he couldn't say Shibboleth, for he could not frame to pronounce it right. Then they took him and slew him at the passages of Jordan. And there fell at that time of the Ephraimites 42,000. This is probably the only battle in history where 42,000 men were killed for not being able to pronounce the SH sound. And Jephthah judged Israel for 6 years. Then he died. Then died Jephthah the Gileadite, and he was buried in one of the cities of Gilead. So he didn't judge for very long, actually, only about 6 years. He had lived a rough wilderness life and took its toll, I guess, on him. And he died young, and he might not have been that young, but he died after a short time after his victory, and he left no sons to carry on his family name. And after him, there was a judge we would call a minor judge simply because we know so little about him, named Ibzan of Bethlehem. He judged Israel, and he had 30 sons and 30 daughters, whom he sent abroad and took in 30 daughters from abroad for his sons, and he judged Israel 7 years. He had 30 sons and daughters, and what it says there is he sent his daughters out of the tribe of Benjamin, out of the tribe of Judah, out of Bethlehem, to give them to be wives of men outside the tribe, but he brought in the same number of women from outside the tribe to give to his 30 sons for wives. Why this is mentioned, I don't know. It must have been just kind of an unusual thing to do. Then died Ibzan and was buried at Bethlehem. And after him, there is another judge of whom we know very little. Elon, a Zebulunite, judged Israel, and he judged for 10 years. And Elon, the Zebulunite, died and was buried in Aijalon in the country of Zebulun. And after him, another judge, another minor judge, we would say, Abdon, the son of Hillel, a Pirathonite, judged Israel. And he had 40 sons and 30 nephews. The King James says nephews. In the Hebrew, it's sons' sons, so that would really be grandsons. Nephews is not a good translation. He had 40 sons and 30 grandsons, 70 male offspring in all, as it turns out, that rode on 70 ass colts. And he judged Israel 8 years. Now, when it says that his sons and his grandsons rode on the same number of asses, this is saying something about their dignity and their prosperity. In those days, before there were horses and camels in Israel, before they possessed those things in abundance, for a man to have an ass for riding on was a luxury. If a man had an ass, usually it was for carrying burdens. But ordinarily men would lead their ass on foot. They would walk with their ass, and the ass would carry the load. But here, these men rode on theirs. They were men of luxury, men of affluence. That's what is being said of them. And Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Pirathonite, died and was buried in Pirathon in the land of Ephraim in the mount of the Amalekites. Okay, now we come to the story of Samson. This time it's the Philistines again who are the troublemakers. Samson is a very interesting story, a very pathetic story. I suppose of all the stories, the story of Jephthah and his daughter and the story of Samson are the most pathetic. If Jephthah's daughter was not sacrificed, as we suggested that she was not, then it's not quite as tragic. But on the assumption that he did sacrifice his daughter, as some believe, then it, of course, is a very sad story. But this story is very sad because here is a man who was called of God from his womb, like John the Baptist was. Both men, John the Baptist and Samson, were, and Samuel also in the Old Testament. Samuel, John the Baptist, and Samson were called to be Nazarites from the womb. In Numbers chapter 6, there is the law of the Nazarite vow. And this was a vow that any Jew could take, if he wished, for a period of time. He could pretty much decide how long it was going to be. But as I understand from the Jewish tradition, it had to be at least a month time. But it could be any length of time up to a lifetime. And in the time of the vow, they would grow their hair and their beard without cutting it at all. They couldn't touch it. They couldn't trim it for the whole period of their vow. And they could not touch anything that was a product of the grapevine. They couldn't eat raisins or grapes or drink wine. And they couldn't drink any strong drink. And also they could not touch a dead body. These were the three things that characterized the Nazarite vow. Each of those things probably has symbolic value. I don't have time to go into them. I imagine maybe John did a bit when he taught Numbers. But there were some men, not very many that we know of, but there were some who were Nazarites not by their own choosing, but by the choosing of God, where either their parents or God himself determined that they would be Nazarites from the womb. Samuel's mother, Hannah, promised God that if he would give her a son, that she would commit him to the Lord as a Nazarite for life. Her son was Samuel, and he was a Nazarite, so he never cut his hair, drank wine, or came near a dead body. The same, of course, is true of John the Baptist. The pictures of John the Baptist in religious art are not very accurate ordinarily, though they usually try to depict him as sort of a wild character. I've never seen one yet that had him with a hair and beard that had never been cut. I mean, obviously his hair would be down to his waist or beyond by the time he was 30 years old. I mean, my hair was grown down to the middle of my back in just 3 years of growth when I was a teenager. And so I imagine that he could have hair down to his feet by the time he's 30. And Samson was like that too. Now, of course, in those days, people had long hair, didn't just wear it hanging down. Women didn't, and probably the men didn't either. When they had Nazarite vow, they probably would just roll it up in a bun or something and wear it under something. At any rate, here's a man who is dedicated to be separated to the Lord. The word Nazarite means separated. And here's a guy who's supposed to be specially the Lord's, like Israel was. In fact, you might even say, in a sense, he might be a picture and a type of Israel, though not in every sense, perhaps. But here's a picture of a guy who had a special call from his womb, from his mother's womb, of course, from his own birth, and yet his life degenerated. Actually, in the early stories of Samson, we don't have anything written against him. He's a very mighty man, as we all know. Some people actually believe that the story of Samson became the source of the legends of the Greeks about Hercules, because he did mighty superhuman things. And it is possible that the stories of Samson were carried by the Phoenicians in their trading throughout the world to other countries, which developed stories based on this true story. They developed their myths about gods like Hercules, and it is actually suggested by some scholars that that's where the Hercules myths originated. The story of Samson is, he's given a lot of attention, and yet he did very little in terms of wiping out the enemy as compared to, say, Gideon. Gideon wiped out 135,000 Midianites. The greatest act of killing the enemies of God that Samson ever did was in his death when he slew 3,000 at a time. And on a previous occasion, he had slain 1,000 with the jawbone of an ass, so there's 4,000 total there. And then there's one other occasion where it says he slew a great number, and the number is not given. But certainly it was only a few thousand Philistines in all that he ever conquered, and he never, to our knowledge, delivered Israel from oppression of the Philistines. The Philistines remained, after Samson's time, as before, a continual nuisance to them. So in saying he was a judge of Israel, again, we don't have any reference to him judging or ruling Israel like the others did. He was more like Shamgar, who was mentioned at the end of chapter 3. Shamgar is said to have been raised up as a judge, but he didn't, as far as we know, judge Israel. All he did was slew 600 Philistines with an ox goad. And he was sort of like a momentary hero. On occasions, he was God's man to avenge Israel on some of their enemies. But really, there were a few Philistines who got killed, a few thousand. But he'd never delivered his people. And that is probably because of the moral compromise in his life. It was said to his mother when she was to conceive him that he would begin to deliver his people Israel. That was the prediction. When he would come, he would begin to deliver Israel from the Philistines. It was not suggested that he would complete the job, even before he was born. But he really didn't do a whole lot to deliver Israel. Most of his fights with the Philistines were to avenge personal grudges, not so much to deliver the Israelites in any sense. I mean, even when he slew the 3,000 at the end of his life, there's no sense in which we have an indication that the Jews were liberated by that. It was just a matter of personal vengeance for his two eyes that they'd put out. He said, "Lord, give me one chance to avenge the loss of my eyes on these people." And almost every time that we see Samson slaying Philistines, it's because of a personal dispute he has with them. And a lot of times it has to do with the way they treated him with respect to the women among them that he was infatuated with. So he wasn't really a judge like Gideon or like some of these guys. And we can see how that the early judges, this is Samson, as far as we know, was the last of the judges. The early judges like Othniel and Ehud, they were reformers. They turned the people of Israel back to God, and during their time, the people pursued the ways of God, at least somewhat, whether wholeheartedly or not, we're not told. But they had peace, they had complete deliverance under those judges, and those men were raised up by God in to be religious leaders as well, apparently. But Samson was no political leader, as near as we can tell, no religious leader. He was just a strong man who killed a bunch of bad guys. As I said yesterday, he's really very much the Rambo type. You know, he just, in the Rambo movies, you always know who the bad guys are, and he's just going around wiping out a bunch of them. So that's what happens, but doesn't really change anything ultimately. Okay, the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines 40 years. There was a certain man of Zorah, of the family of the Danites, the tribe of Dan, whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and bare not, like so many women who eventually gave birth to famous Israelites. This woman was barren. You remember that Sarah had been barren, and her womb was miraculously opened. After her, her daughter-in-law Rebecca was barren, and then after that, her daughter-in-law Rachel was barren, and Hannah was barren, and Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist, was barren. There's a lot of women in the Bible who were barren, and who, through prayer and divine intervention by a miracle, were given sons who became very famous and very wonderful sons. This was another of those cases. Manoah's wife was barren. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto the woman. Now this angel of the Lord, I believe, is almost certainly Jesus. I'm not sure that I could say that every time we've read of an angel or the angel of the Lord in the book of Judges that I'm convinced it's Jesus, but in this case I'm convinced it is because of some later things that are said. I believe this is what we call a theophany, an appearance of Christ prior to his incarnation on earth. The angel of the Lord appeared unto the woman and said to her, Behold, now thou art barren and bearest not, but thou shalt conceive and bear a son. Now therefore beware, I pray thee, and drink not wine nor strong drink, and eat not any unclean thing. For lo, thou shalt conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite unto God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines. Now notice what he required of the mother. She should drink no wine or anything grape product, and she should not eat any unclean thing, because wine in itself was not an unclean thing to most Jews, but to a Nazarite it was to be. Now, she was not required herself to take the Nazarite vow. She wasn't told, for instance, to grow her hair out. Of course, she probably already did, or to stay away from dead bodies. She was just told not to drink any grape juice. Why? Because she was going to conceive, and of course, what a woman eats during her pregnancy becomes the nourishment for the fetus within. And this child was to have no grape products in his system ever. I mean, from conception even. During the time in the womb, there would be no product of the grape that would go into his mother's system to get into his system. That's the point here. She was not made to take the Nazarite vow herself, but since her child was to be a Nazarite from the womb, then, of course, it would be necessary for her not to drink any grape juice either, or wine, because that would then get it into the system of this baby who was supposed to be a Nazarite and shouldn't drink such things. Then he says in verse 6, the woman came and told her husband, saying, A man of God came to me. She didn't know it was a divine messenger. She thought it was just a prophet. And his countenance was like unto the countenance of an angel of God, very terrible. But I asked him not whence he was, where he was from, neither told he me his name. Now, she apparently thought this was a mere human being, because she said, I didn't ask where he was from, like what town he was from or what his name was. Later on, we're told specifically in verse 16 that Manoah, the husband, even after he talked to this angel of the Lord, he knew not that he was an angel of the Lord. Up to a late point in this relationship between the angel of the Lord and this couple, they didn't realize they were dealing with an angel or with a divine manifestation. But he said to me, Behold, thou shalt conceive and bear a son, and now drink no wine or strong drink, neither eat any unclean thing, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death. That is at least what he was commissioned to be. Of course, he broke that vow himself before his death, but that was not a prophecy, but a commission. It wasn't prophesied that he be a Nazarite to his death, but rather that was his obligation and his duty to be. Then Manoah entreated the Lord and said, O my Lord, let the man of God which thou didst send come again to us and teach us what we shall do unto the child that shall be born. And God hearkened unto the voice of Manoah, and the angel of God came again unto the woman as she sat in the field, but Manoah, her husband, was not with her. Now notice this. The angel appears twice to the woman when the husband is not there. And the husband was curious. He'd like to see this man and find out what was going on too. And he asked for more information. Oh, well, if we're going to have such a divine child, you better tell us what we need to do to raise it. As it turns out, the angel doesn't tell them how to raise it, except he only repeats what he'd said earlier, that the woman should not drink wine or eat any unclean thing, as it says in verse 14. He just reiterates what he'd already said. So he doesn't really even answer Manoah's question. And he doesn't even appear to Manoah. However, she runs and gets him, and so he comes. But, of course, God could have chosen a time when the husband and wife were together to appear. And it seems like, basically, God is dealing directly with the woman deliberately. Why? In this case, I can't say why he is, but perhaps it's simply showing that God wanted to honor the mother in this situation. Maybe she was more a person of faith than he was. She certainly was a clearer thinker than he was, because after they realized it was an angel of the Lord, he was afraid they'd die, and she reasoned with him and said, no, if God was going to kill us, why would he give us this message, and so forth. And so she calmed him down. But Manoah seems to have been, I won't say less devout, but he doesn't seem to have been as much of a theologian as his wife was. And the angel appeared to her and not to him originally. Both. So he doesn't give any new information, just says the same thing again. And Manoah said unto the angel of the Lord, I pray thee, let us detain thee until we shall have made ready a kid for thee. He wanted to prepare some food. And the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, though thou detain me, I will not eat of thy bread. And if thou wilt offer a burnt offering, thou must offer it unto the Lord. For Manoah knew not that he was an angel of the Lord. And Manoah said unto the angel of the Lord, what is thy name, that when thy sayings come to pass, we may do thee honor? Now, it's hard to know exactly whether Manoah was really believing all this or whether he's just going along with the gag, as he thinks, you know, whether he doubts that this is really a word from God. Sometimes the things he says make me wonder whether he was really buying the story entirely. But he says, well, you know, you might as well tell us your name so that when this comes past, we can spread your name around and you become a famous prophet around here. And the angel of the Lord said unto him, why askest thou this after my name, seeing it is secret? Marginal reading gives us an alternative rendering of the word secret from the Hebrew. The word could be rendered wonderful. Why do you ask after my name, seeing it is wonderful? Of course, you would remember immediately Isaiah 9:6, which speaks of Jesus. His name shall be called Wonderful. Although I must say that the Hebrew word here is different than the word wonderful in Isaiah 9:6. But both words can be translated wonderful in the English. I would also remind you that this is the same kind of response that the theophany that wrestled with Jacob gave. When Jacob said, what is your name? It said, why is it that you ask after my name? But he didn't go on to say, seeing it is secret or wonderful. But it seems to me likely that this is the same person that wrestled with Jacob. And the person that wrestled with Jacob was God. Jacob said so himself. He says, I've seen God face to face, and I've lived. So I believe this is a theophany. So Manoah took a kid with a meat offering and offered it upon a rock unto the Lord. And the angel did wondrously, and Manoah and his wife looked on. For it came to pass when the flame went up toward heaven from the altar, that the angel of the Lord ascended in the flame on the altar. He actually went up in the smoke. And Manoah and his wife looked on it, and they fell on their faces to the ground. But the angel of the Lord did no more appear to Manoah and his wife. Then Manoah knew that he was an angel of the Lord. And Manoah said unto his wife, we shall surely die because we have seen God. And his wife said unto him, if the Lord were pleased to kill us, he would not have received a burnt offering and a meat offering at our hands, neither would he have showed us all these things, nor would as at this time have told us such things as these. And the woman bare a son, and called his name Samson, which, as I recall, means little son. I think Samson means little son. And the child grew, and the Lord blessed him. So at this point, we have nothing recorded against Samson. He grew up like Samuel and like John the Baptist with the blessing of the Lord upon them because of their separation to the Lord. And the Spirit of the Lord began to move him at times in the camp of Dan between Zorah and Eshtaol. And that probably is a summary statement of the next several chapters. That is to say, during his lifetime, there were times when the Spirit of the Lord moved him. And for example, we're given chapters 14 and 15 to give examples of when the Lord moved him and in what way that happened. And so we'll go on to see. Chapter 14, and Samson went down to Timnath, which was a Philistine city, and saw a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. And he came up and told his father and his mother and said, I have seen a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. Now, therefore, get her for me to wife. In those days, it was not proper for a man to personally go and court a woman. It had to be arranged between parents. The parents of the man and the bride were the ones who made the arrangements. There was also sometimes a third party called the friend of the bridegroom. And that is an office that was held in a particular case of matchmaking. The friend was like a matchmaker. He would go as the agent of the groom to give presents or to make arrangements or to basically act as the agent of the groom in the situation, because very often the groom would have very little contact with the bride before the actual wedding. And there is a friend that also figures in this story. As it turns out, the wife ends up marrying Samson's friend, and not a person who is really a friend of his, but as it says at the end of chapter 14 and verse 20, his companion whom he had used as his friend, meaning he had used this person to fulfill the role of the bridegroom's friend, which was an office more than a statement that they were really friendly toward each other. John the Baptist, you remember, when he was told that Jesus was baptizing more people than John, said, well, it's not the bridegroom's friend that gets the bride, it's the bridegroom who does. Therefore, the friend rejoices to see the bride come to the groom. And what he was saying is that the church is the bride, and Jesus is the groom, and John the Baptist is just the bridegroom's friend. That is, the one who went ahead to make arrangements with the bride to prepare the way for the groom. And he was saying, well, this is the way it should be. The groom now has the bride. I'm the bridegroom's friend. I shouldn't be the one baptizing all the people. He's the one who's supposed to have the bride. So John the Baptist used this kind of custom just as an illustration of his relationship to Jesus. But here, Samson comes to his father, because it would be his father, first of all, who would have to take the initiative to approach the father of this Philistine girl to arrange for the marriage. Then his father and his mother said to him, is there never a woman among the daughters of thy brethren or among all my people that thou goest to take a wife of the uncircumcised Philistines? Now he says, is there never a woman among our people? It almost sounds like there have been other occasions when Samson had fallen for outsiders, for foreign women. And his father says, can't you ever find someone local? You know, can't you find one of our own race? Ever? You know, in saying, is there never any one of our people? It almost sounds like there have been a number of times previous that are unrecorded where Samson kind of had a crush on Philistine girls or women who were not of their race. But Samson was not very submissive to his parents in this. He said to his father, get her for me, for she pleases me well. A submissive son would have said, well, Dad, if you really think she's not right for me, maybe I'd better just wait and see what comes up among our own people, if that's what you're looking for. But he says, listen, this is what I want, get her for me, ordering his father around. He could probably beat up his dad if he wanted to. But his father and his mother knew not that it was of the Lord that he sought an occasion against the Philistines, for at that time the Philistines had dominion over Israel. Now, that's an interesting statement. The parents really thought that they were standing in the Lord's interest. They thought, you know, the people of God should only marry other people of God. And that is true. Basically, intermarriage between religions, between the Jews and other religions, was forbidden. But as it turned out, God arranged that this marriage never took place. But God did want the arrangements for the marriage to take place. This is a strange thing. It was of the Lord that he put this desire in Samson, or that he let Samson's desire carry him in this direction. so that he could make an occasion against the Philistines. Now, this suggests to me that the Philistines weren't really... God didn't really feel like he had that good a reason to judge the Philistines in this case. They must not have been too oppressive or too unjust or whatever. They were just there. They shouldn't have been taken over the land as they were. But God wanted to get a just cause to drive them out. And it shows that God doesn't just arbitrarily wipe out people he doesn't like. He waits until he has a just reason. And so he brought about a circumstance that would stir the Philistines up to do something that was unjust. And then God would have a just cause for sending Samson against them. And, of course, the parents of Samson had no idea what the Lord had up his sleeve in this situation. It's a really strange thing. Even we, looking back at it, say, boy, that's kind of strange to think of God wanting this arrangement to be made, even though he didn't really want Samson to end up marrying the girl. I told you the other day that there was a case where it seemed like I had seven fleeces pointing me in the direction of marrying this one person, and it didn't turn out to be the Lord's will after all. You know, I sometimes wonder, maybe God just wanted me to move in that direction at that time, but he didn't really want me to marry him. But, you know, you just don't know some of these things. It's strange, because here's a clear-cut case where God did not intend for Samson to marry a Philistine woman. Yet he did intend for arrangements to be made, or for him to think he was going to marry this woman. And it was because there was some overarching purpose that God had, and as we are told here by the writer, looking back in retrospect, he understands why this was. The Lord wanted the Philistines to have an opportunity to cheat Samson so that Samson would have a just cause to start killing them off, basically. Although we might say that Samson killed them off out of proportion to the crime, but still, this is what happened. So this was of the Lord, that he might have an occasion against the Philistines. That is, God wanted to get Samson angry at the Philistines. And maybe this is another thing to consider. Samson was too friendly with the Philistines. That's why he was, you know, feeling the liberty to marry one of them and so forth. He was supposed to be the one to deliver his people from the Philistines, and he was cohorting with them. He wanted to marry one of them. He wanted to have Philistine parents-in-law. He was obviously at peace with the Philistines because he'd go to Timnath and, you know, kind of probably hang out in the bars there or something and saw a girl they liked and decided to take her. And, you know, he wasn't the enemy of the Philistines. And God said, I got to get this guy angry at these people. He's supposed to deliver his people from them. And so God arranges this whole thing where he falls in love with this Philistine girl, and God has it all worked out that he's going to get badly burned by the Philistines and he's never going to be friendly toward them again. And so the parents didn't understand all that, and probably we wouldn't either if we were them at the time, and I'm not sure I understand it even now. Verse 5, then went Samson down and his father and mother to Timnath and came to the vineyards of Timnath, and behold, a young lion roared against him. Now apparently his parents walked ahead of him and didn't see that he encountered this lion. And he just went down, it says, and he killed the lion just like it was a baby goat. He just tore it with his bare hands, apparently broke its jaws open and so forth. And he left it, and he tore its body open and just left its carcass there. Well, so far he hasn't done anything wrong. But after a time, when he returned to take the woman, now see, this was on the first trip he killed the lion. We went down to make the arrangements. Later, how much later we don't know, he went down to actually marry the girl and have their regular 7-day marriage feast, which was common at the time. He saw the same lion again, and by this time a hive of bees had taken up residence in the lion's body. And Samson must have not only had strong muscles, but strong skin as well, because he walked right up and took honey out of a beehive with the swarm of bees all around it. I mean, he must have had skin of steel to get away with that. Because you don't just walk up to a swarm of bees and start reaching into their hive and pulling honey out without getting hurt. But he took some of the honey, and he gave it to his parents also. Apparently it was a rare treat. But it says specifically he didn't tell them where he got it. And the reason this story is told is because it became the occasion of a riddle that he proposed to the other men at the wedding. In verse 10 it says, so his father went down unto the woman, and Samson made there a feast, and so... As used the young men to do. Now, this used to be the custom, that they make a 7-day feast at the time of their wedding. And it came to pass when they saw him that they brought 30 companions to be with him. Now again, the Philistines and Samson are not enemies yet. And so the Philistines produced 30 men to attend, to be friends with him, to be his companions. He didn't apparently have a lot of friends, so they had to kind of appoint some guys to be his companions at the feast. And Samson said unto them, "Now will I put forth a riddle to you." So as he sat around with these guys, he did the same kind of thing that Orientals love to do, especially Middle Eastern Arab types. They like to sit around and propose mysteries and riddles to each other to see if they can solve them. The wisdom literature that we have in the Bible, the Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, is almost certainly a product of this kind of conversation that the Jews and the Arabs love to engage in, especially the wise among them. Like sit around and propose hard sayings and hard questions. Remember that the Queen of Sheba came a long distance to hear Solomon's wisdom and to test him or prove him with hard questions. She wanted to pose some hard questions, some riddles to him, see if he could answer them. And the Bible says he answered every one of them. Solomon did. Well, Samson, you know, as many of the people of his time, sitting around for 7 days waiting to take your wife, you know, a seven-day wedding feast is, you know, what do you do for 7 days while you're waiting for your wife to come to you? Well, you sit around and tell riddles. And so he sat down with these 30 guys. So I'll give you a riddle and see if you can answer this. If you can certainly declare it to me within the 7 days of the feast and find it out, then I will give you 30 sheets or shirts, an alternate translation, and 30 changes of garment. Now, changes of clothing were expensive in those days, and they were considered to be things of great value. And so he says, if I win, you give me 30 changes of garments, but if you cannot declare it to me, then, I'm sorry, if you can, I'll give you 30, and if you can't, you give me 30 sheets and 30 changes of garments. Now, really, this was would go easier on them than on him, because if he lost, he'd have to come up personally with 30 changes of garments to give them. Whereas if they lost, they'd each have to produce only one to give to him. On the other hand, if he won, he came out better than any of them, because he got 30 for himself, and they each got only one for themselves if they win. So it was an interesting risk thing. You know, it was kind of expensive gamble, as it turned out. And they were up for the challenge. So they said, well, let's hear the riddle, that we may hear it. Put it forth. And verse 14 says, he said to them, out of the eater came forth meat, and out of the strong came forth sweetness. Obviously referring to the lion and the honey in it. On his way there, he had been inspired with this riddle. And they're supposed to explain what in the world that means. And they could not in 3 days expound the riddle. And it came to pass on the seventh day that they said unto Samson's wife, entice thy husband, that he may declare unto us the riddle, lest we burn thee and thy father's house with fire. Have ye called us to take away what we have? Is it not so? So they basically came to the woman and said, listen, you invited us to this feast so that we could get ripped off for 30 changes of clothing by your husband. Now listen, you better find out the answer and tell us the answer, because if you don't, we're going to burn you and your father's house. And so she was really under pressure here. And Samson's wife wept before him, as women are prone to do when they're manipulative, and said, thou dost hate me and not love me. Doesn't that sound familiar to married men? Okay. Thou dost but hate me and lovest me not. Thou hast put forth a riddle unto the children of my people, and you haven't told me. And he said to her, listen, I haven't even told my parents, and I'm going to tell you. And she wept before him for the rest of the 7 days. Actually, it says it was on the seventh day they approached her. Almost certainly, they approached her on the third day, because it says that in 3 days they couldn't answer it. And they probably approached her every day after that, including the seventh day. And when it says they came to her on the seventh day, they had probably come to her for several days before that, but they were really leaning on her on the seventh day, because that was their time limit for coming up with the answer. And for the remainder of the 7 days, from the first time they leaned on her, she was leaning on Samson, crying and carrying on and so forth, and saying, you don't love me because you don't tell me all your secrets. And so she continued to do that. And so finally, of course, he had to break down. And he told her. It says, because she lay sore upon him. And that is, she leaned on him so hard to tell. And so she told the riddle to the children of her people. And the men of the city said unto him on the seventh day before the sun was down, right before the deadline, what is sweeter than honey? And what is stronger than a lion? In other words, his reference to the sweetness coming out of the strong and out of the eater comes the meat. He says, oh, that must be talking about a lion and about honey, right? You know, and obviously they didn't come right out and say that they knew all the details, but it was clear that they had gotten the answer. And it was also obviously clear that they hadn't gotten it by fair means, because no one would ever have gotten it from the way he posed the riddle. So he knew that they'd gotten it from his wife, because he had just told his wife. And then suddenly they come up with the answer. He knew something was afoot. And so he said to them, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you wouldn't have found out my riddle. I don't think I need to expound on that much. But Samson's wife was given to his companion. I'm sorry. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he went down to Ashkelon and slew 30 men of them and took their clothes and gave the change of garments to those who expounded the riddle. So he says, okay, you win. I'll give you 30 garments of clothes. So he slays 30 of their companions, 30 of their fellow countrymen, and gives them their clothes. It's one way to fulfill your debts. And his anger was kindled, and he went up to his father's house. But Samson's wife was given to his companion, whom he had used as his friend. Now, apparently unknown to Samson, after he went in anger to his father's house, he left his wife at her father's house, because apparently he realized that she had betrayed him. He didn't know the circumstances. He didn't know she was under duress and that she was threatened with death if she didn't, but he was just angry at her. And so he left her for a period of time, but he intended later, when he cooled down, to come and take her back. But in the meantime, unbeknown to him, she was given to another guy to be a wife. But it came to pass within a while after, in the time of wheat harvest, that Samson visited his wife with a kid. And he said, I will go in to my wife into the chamber. In other words, he went down there wanting to sleep with her. But her father would not permit him to go in. And her father said, I verily thought that you had utterly hated her, therefore I gave her to your companion. Is not her younger sister fairer than she? Take her, I pray thee, instead of her. In other words, Samson had not yet apparently slept with her during the festivities of the 7 days. Those were only preparatory to taking her into his home. And so she had not slept with him yet. Now, later in the year, he decides, well, I guess I'll go sleep with her after all. And when he gets there, he finds that she's been given to someone else. But her father says, well, listen, her sister's a lot prettier than she is, and she's still available. Why don't you take her? And Samson said concerning them, now shall I be more blameless than the Philistines, though I do them a displeasure. Here, for the first time, he's resolved to really hurt the Philistines. He's really angry now. And it says, so Samson went, his first act of vengeance was he took 300 foxes, or more proper translation would be jackals. Foxes, such as we know them, weren't common in the area, but jackals, which are very much like foxes, are. And he took firebrands, which means torches, and turned tail to tail and put a firebrand in the midst between two tails. That means he took 300 jackals. He tied them tail to tail in couples so that there were 150 coupled jackals and tied together by their tails and with a torch attached to each of their tails. So 150 torches attached to 300 jackals, and then he let them go. Now, how he caught these jackals, I don't know. But there's a lot of things he did that I don't know how he did it, except that we just say the Lord gave him the strength. Anyway, he let them go in the standing wheat and the standing corn of the Philistines to burn up both the shocks and also the standing corn with the vineyards and the olives. So there was a great fire that was caused by this that burned up the crops of the Philistines, and this was the punishment he put on them for this one act of betraying him, taking his wife and giving her to another man. Then the Philistines said, who has done this? And they answered, Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite, because he hath taken his wife and given her to his companion. And the Philistines came up and burned her and her father with fire. Notice this. This is what she tried to avoid. When she betrayed her husband and told the riddle to his companion, she did so that she wouldn't get burned with fire and her father too. But it shows that by sinning, if you sin to try to escape calamity, it's not necessarily, justice may involve you in that calamity. Anyway, he that seeks to save his life shall lose it. But whoever would lose his life for a virtuous, godly cause would find it. Well, here she and her father get burned up after all. Now, you might think that Samson should be pleased with the Philistines now because they've actually avenged him on the criminals, the ones who took his wife and the wife herself who cheated on him in this way. Vengeance has been done. You might think his wrath would be abated against the Philistines. However, there still remains displeasure. And especially, the Philistines now are not happy with Samson. Now, Samson might feel like his anger could be abated at this time, but the Philistines are still angry at him. And so the war continues. And Samson said unto them, though ye have done this, yet will I be avenged of you, and after that I will cease. So he says, I'm going to still do a little more damage, and then I'll be finished with you. And he smote them hip and thigh with a great slaughter. And he went down and dwelt at the top of the rock Edom. Now, hip and thigh is just a figure of speech in the Hebrew that's similar to us saying right and left. He slew them right and left. He just, all over the place, he was swinging and knocked them down. We don't know how many of them he slew. And the Philistines went up and pitched in Judah and spread themselves in Lehi. Now, Lehi means the jaw. And it probably later came to be known as the jaw because this is the place where Samson slew 1,000 of them with the jawbone. But the name of the place came to be called Lehi, the jaw. And the men of Judah said, why are ye come up against us? And the Philistines answered, to bind Samson we are come up, to do to him as he hath done to us. Then 3,000 men of Judah went to the top of the rock Edom, where Samson was hiding out, and said to Samson, knowest thou not that the Philistines are rulers over us? What is this thou hast done unto us? Here, they didn't appreciate him being a judge. Usually they appreciated Gideon and people like that, but Samson was not behaving in a responsible manner. He wasn't leading the armies out to deliverance or anything. He was just kind of venting a personal grudge and vengeance. And so they said, don't you know this isn't the way to do it? There are rulers. You know, we got to kind of not rock the boat. They'll do us harm. And it says, and he said unto them, as they did unto me, so have I done unto them. Notice the spirit of vengeance here, both in Samson and in the Philistines. They said, as he did to us, let us do to him. He says, as they did to me, so I did to them. You know, it's like, instead of saying, well, maybe I was a little out of hand, he's justifying himself and saying, well, after all, they hurt me first. They drew first blood, you know. And that's, in fact, that's why the first Rambo movie was called First Blood, because he did a lot of outrageous, horrible things and killed a lot of people. But they're the first ones. They drew blood first, and that justified what he did in that movie, supposedly. That's where Samson's coming from, too. Here, he was wronged by two people, his wife and her father, and he slays hip and thigh, you know, a multitude of Philistines for it, besides burn up their crops, even though they had made an attempt to right the wrong. So he's just kind of a wrathful, vengeful kind of a guy. And they said to him, we are come down to bind thee, that we may deliver thee into the hand of the Philistines. And Samson said to them, swear to me that ye will not fall upon me yourselves. And they spake unto him, saying, no, but we will bind thee fast and deliver thee into their hand, and surely we will not kill thee. And they bound him with two new cords and brought him up from the rock. Now, he apparently submitted to them binding him after they promised not to kill him themselves. Why did he say that? I mean, obviously the Philistines were planning to kill him. What did it matter to him whether it was the Jews or the Philistines? The answer to that, I think, is this, that he only had supernatural strength when the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. And that wasn't at all times. As we saw at the end of chapter 13, the Spirit of the Lord came on him at times, or began to move him at times in the camp of Dan. And I think that he knew that God would not strengthen him to defend himself against his own countrymen, simply because he wasn't there to judge Judah. He was there to bring judgment on the Philistines. So he didn't want to submit himself to them and let them bite him if they were going to kill him, because he wouldn't be able to defend himself against them supernaturally. But if they turned him over to the Philistines, he was confident that the Lord would be with him and he would be able to save himself from them. So they promised they wouldn't kill him, and he let them bind him. And notice, with two new cords. Later he told Delilah that if he was bound with new cords, that he'd be as weak as other men. But on this earlier occasion, it's clear that he was bound with new cords and he was not as weak as other men. In verse 14, and when he came into unto Lehi, the Philistines shouted against him as they were all rejoicing. Ah, we got the enemy now. He's trapped. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and the cords that were upon his arms became as flax that was burnt in the fire. In other words, they became totally weak, like threads, and his bands loosed from off his hands. And he found a new jawbone of an ass that is recently dead. lying around. And he put forth his hand and took it and slew 1,000 men with it. And Samson said, with the jawbone of an ass, heaps upon heaps, referring to the bodies of the dead, heaps upon heaps, 1,000 men. With the jaw of an ass have I slain 1,000 men. And it came to pass, when he had made an end of speaking, that he cast away the jawbone out of his hand and called the place Ramoth-Lehi. Now, Lehi, as you know, means the jaw. Ramoth-Lehi means either the lifting up of the jawbone or casting away of the jawbone. And he was sore thirsty, and he called on the Lord and said, thou hast given this great deliverance into the hand of thy servant, and now shall I die for thirst and fall to the hand of the uncircumcised, meaning the Philistines. But God clave a hollow place that was in the jaw, and there came water thereout. Now, it sounds like it was this jawbone of the ass that produced the water. But probably that's not what is intended. In the Hebrew, it says there was a hollow place in Lehi, the name of the place. And, of course, the name of the place means the jaw, so the translators weren't sure whether it should be translated Lehi as the name of the place or whether it should translate the jaw. But since it specifically said that he had cast away the jaw, and I have a feeling he had the power to throw things pretty far, he probably didn't get the water out of that jawbone that he had already cast away, but out of the place that was named Lehi, which means the jaw, there was a hollow place that produced water. And so God produced water for him there in answer to his prayers. And so he named the place En-Hakkari. And the reason he named it that is because it means the well of him who called or who cried, because God gave him that well or found that water. Again, that suggests the water was not out of the jawbone. There was a well there. He called it the well of him who cried. Okay, so it was, which is in Lehi unto this day. And he judged Israel in the days of the Philistines 20 years. But in what sense he judged them, it's not clear. Now, apparently later in his life, then went Samson to Gaza, and he saw there a harlot, and he went into her. He was pretty much morally a wreck at this time. And so he went into this prostitute, and it was told to the Gazites, saying, now this was a Philistine city. Gaza was one of the five major Philistine cities. It was told to the inhabitants of the city, saying, Samson is here. And they compassed him in and laid wait for him all night at the gate of the city. And they were quiet all night, saying, in the morning, when it is day, we shall kill him. But he must have suspected that they were there to catch him in the morning, so he didn't stay all night. Samson lay until midnight, and then he arose at midnight and took the doors of the gate of the city and the two posts, and went away with them, barred and all, and he put them upon his shoulders and carried them up to the top of the hill that is called Hebron. Now, cities that had walls around them shut their gates and locked them at night just so that invaders couldn't come in and take them at night. And those who were lying in wait for him felt, well, certainly, now that the gates are shut, he won't be able to leave until morning. So they encamped around the city. But they probably didn't keep very close watch in the middle of the night. They probably slept thinking, well, he's not going to get out until morning when the gates are open. So we'll wait for him to come out. But he didn't wait for morning. He just took the gates right off the hinges. And we're not talking about, chain link. We're talking about gates that are fortified against battering rams and arrows and spears and even against fire, probably had metal, strong brass hinges and everything. And he just tore it off the thing. And rather than just laying it there, he decided to give them extra problems to worry about. He carried it with him a certain distance and let them decide how to bring it back. And it came to pass afterward that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah, and no doubt she was a prostitute as well, though it doesn't say so specifically. And the lords of the Philistines, we find her certainly willing to sell her virtue to the Philistines for 1,100 pieces of silver. The lords of the Philistines came to her and said unto her, entice him and see wherein his great strength lieth. They couldn't figure out why he was so strong. Some people picture Samson as a huge muscle-bound guy like Arnold Schwarzenegger or something like that. I mean, almost all the religious pictures of Samson pushing down the pillars and stuff picture him like that, these huge muscles. However, it says that they couldn't figure out why he was so strong. I mean, if a guy's got these bulging biceps and stuff, walking down the street, it's not going to be a mystery why he's so strong. They're not going to say, now I wonder why he's so strong with these huge muscles bulging out all over the place. Probably he was a man of average build. Maybe a little better than average, but it's very clear that all the supernatural strength he demonstrated was when the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. In other words, it was a supernatural thing. It wasn't just that he, pumped iron a lot more than most guys and was able to kill more people with a jawbone than an ass than the average guy could do. It's miraculous. It was miraculous, and it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the size of his muscles. And so they couldn't figure out why he was so strong. Just looking at him, you wouldn't think he could do things like that. And so they said, there's something magic here. There's some power here that we're not aware of. You find out. They found out that this woman had him wrapped around her little finger. So they came to her and offered her 1,100 pieces of silver. Well, to make a long story short, she asked him several times what would make him weak. And he played with her a little bit, and he told her lies the first few times. The first thing he said, if he was bound with seven green withes in verse 8, or actually new cords, then he'd be like any other man, which was false. She did it, and she said, the Philistines are upon you. There were Philistines hiding there, ready to grab him, but they apparently didn't disclose themselves. And he broke them when he woke up. She had him go to sleep, and she bound him. And then she said, the Philistines are here, and he woke up and broke them. And the Philistines stayed put, so he didn't know the Philistines were really there. He thought that she and he were just playing a game together. And so she said, well, come on now, what really will make you weak? He said, what you really need to do is take seven new ropes that have never been used for any work, and if you tie me with those, then I'll just be like any other man. And so she tied him up with seven ropes. Whether he was awake or asleep, we don't know. But then when she had him all tied up secure, she said, the Philistines are upon you. And he broke them just like they were nothing. And then she was really getting upset. And she says, come on, tell me the truth. And so he got closer to the truth. He says, well, it has something to do with my hair. But he didn't tell her the truth right off. He's just getting dangerously close to the truth. And he says, what you need to do is you need to weave the seven locks of my hair in a loom, into cloth, more or less. And so she did. I mean, I can't imagine that he was asleep during that process. He was probably just going along with the gag. And so she wove his hair into a loom. And when I guess he did fall asleep, as a matter of fact. I think it even says that he felt, whether he was asleep at the time or not, he was asleep at one point, and she said, it says in verse 14, she fastened it to the pin, and she said to him, the Philistines are upon thee, and Samson, and he awakened out of his sleep, and went away with the pin of the beam and with the web. Then he walked away carrying the loom behind him from his hair. Now, his hair was quite long, remember. He's dragging this big apparatus behind him as he walks away, and says, where are they? I don't see him anyway. He was kind of strong physically, but not very strong mentally, I think. You get the impression. Because next time she says, how can you say you love me when your heart is not with me? He should have learned his lesson last time a woman said that to him. You haven't told me your secret. Well, he had had a chance to learn that lesson. The last time he told a woman his secret because she said he didn't love her, she betrayed him with it. And he knew very well that she was going to try this. I mean, she tried everything else he suggested. Though he didn't necessarily know she was going to turn him over to the Philistines. This is something you have to realize. There were Philistines waiting for him there each time, but they didn't disclose themselves, so he didn't know they were there. He certainly knew that if he told her about his hair, that she would cut it. Because she tried everything else, and she certainly would do that. But he didn't know that she would be so treacherous as after cutting his hair to turn him over to the Philistines. What he was doing was she was basically saying, I can't believe you love me unless you tell me the whole truth. And he was going to have to make a decision like Adam did. When he saw that Eve had disobeyed God, he had to decide, am I going to disobey God and be with my wife, or am I going to obey God and lose her? And that's basically where Samson was with his relationship with Delilah. He said, okay, if I tell her this, I know she's going to cut my hair. And that is my vow to God, that I'll never cut my hair. Yet, if I don't tell her, our relationship's getting tenuous, I'll probably lose her. So he made a wrong decision, decided, in order to keep that relationship, he decided to betray his vow. Now, he didn't know the Philistines would take him and put his eyes out as a result. He didn't know how treacherous she was. He trusted her more than that. He knew she'd cut his hair, and he was willing to part with his vow to God for the sake of that relationship. But again, we see he that seeks to save something against the will of God by doing the wrong thing will lose it. Here, he gave up his vow to God, and he lost her. I mean, he never had her, as it turns out, but he was deceived by her. So he told her, it says in verse 17, he told her all his heart and said to her, there has not come a razor upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite unto God from my mother's womb. If I be shaven, then my strength will go from me, and I shall become weak like any other man. And she knew he was telling the truth this time, just by the way he said it. So she went and got the Philistines, and she made him fall asleep on her knees in verse 19. And she called for a man who came and shaved his head while he was asleep. And then she began to afflict him, and his strength went from him. Verse 20 says, and she said, the Philistines be upon thee, Samson. And he awoke out of his sleep and said, I will go out as at other times before and shake myself. And he knew not that the Lord was departed from him. This is the most tragic line in the whole story, that he didn't know that the Lord had departed from him. Every exploit he had ever done had only been able to be done because the Lord had been with him. And he had just taken the Lord for granted. He'd compromised his walk so many times, going into prostitutes, actually touching the body of a dead lion, which a Nazirite wasn't supposed to touch a dead body at all, and he touched the lion's body to get honey out of it. And, he just played around too much and took too many risks and too many compromises, and the Lord had never forsaken him yet. And so he just assumed, the Lord will never forsake me. And so he went so far as to renounce his vow, as it turns out. I mean, in saying, you can cut my hair, it's the same thing as saying, my vow to God means nothing. And it was almost renouncing the Lord in so many words, saying, I had a vow to the Lord, I'm separated to the Lord, but I guess if I got to choose between you and him, I'll choose you. And when he actually made the decision to give up his relationship with the Lord, he didn't realize God would take that seriously and departed from him. And that kind of tells us something, too, because a lot of people who are Christians have been known to fall into a lot of compromise in their lives and even immorality without, apparently, the Lord absolutely abandoning them. But when a person comes to a point where he consciously renounces his relationship with the Lord, there is no security for a person in a state like that. God may put up with a lot of bunk from you for a while. But the sad thing is, we may feel like, well, we're getting the best of both worlds. We're getting to have our sin and salvation too. But what we're really getting is we're bringing ourselves further and further into the deception that God will never leave us for any purpose. I mean, that nothing we do can endanger our relationship with him. And Samson was so deluded that he thought that if he even ended his vow and threw off his special relationship to God by having his hair cut, that he would still be able to do exploits as before, and the Lord wouldn't have left him, and he knew not that the Lord had departed from him. So he certainly must have expected to wake up without his hair. I mean, when he went to sleep on her knees, he had told her the secret. He must have known he was going to wake up without his hair, but he didn't know the Lord would not be with him anymore. But the Philistines took him, and they put out his eyes and brought him down to Gaza, and they bound him to grind in the prison house, like an animal pulling a millstone to grind the grain. He was made like an animal to pull, probably with other oxen and other animals. He was degraded to the level of an animal to continually humiliate him, and blinded so that he might never be a problem to them again. Howbeit, the hair of his head began to grow again after he was shaven. Then the lords of the Philistines gathered themselves together for to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god. Dagon was a fish god, which there was an image of a fish that represented Dagon. And there was a temple to Dagon, obviously, where all the lords of the Philistines and 3,000 other people came to celebrate. And they were mainly praising Dagon because Dagon had delivered Samson, their enemy, into their hands. Now, some time had elapsed since this event, because Samson's hair was now growing out again as before. But they decided it was time to thank Dagon for this great victory. Now, see, God would have to intervene in a situation like this almost, because Dagon is getting the glory for what God himself did. God's the one who turned Samson over to them. If God hadn't departed from Samson, Dagon couldn't have done a thing to help the Philistines to get Samson under their power. But they made a great feast, a great sacrifice to Dagon, and all the lords of the Philistines were there, and they were celebrating. They said, hey, why don't we call Samson out here and have a little fun with him? It says they made sport of him, or he made them sport, it says in verse 25. And they set him between the pillars. They had him between the pillars of the temple, and they had him entertain them some way or another. Now, I mean, whether they had the little kids come and push him around and spit on him and things like that, that's how they made sport of him. He wasn't just there. He was the entertainment. They brought him out and made fun of him, and they had sport at his expense. They probably had people come up and mock him and push him around and stuff, and sort of like they did to Jesus when they blindfolded him and and said, prophesy, who hit you, you know? And here he was blind also, and they probably did similar things to just mock him and to make merry over his weakness. But they didn't realize his hair had grown out again. And apparently in his own heart, with the growth of his hair, his relationship with the Lord had been renewed. And he had truly repented of taking his vow so lightly in the past. It says in verse 26, Samson said to the little boy who was holding him by the hand, suffer me that I may feel the pillars whereupon the house standeth, that I may lean upon them. The fact that he was being led by a little boy probably was part of the mockery, that here this great warrior was now at the mercy of this child. Furthermore, the fact that it was a child means that the child wouldn't be wise enough to suspect what was about to happen. Let's face it, the Philistines knew that the length of his hair had something to do with his strength in the past. And they could see by looking at him that his hair was grown back. It seems like they would be somewhat cautious, knowing the things he had done before. But the child didn't put two and two together, and so Samson said, why don't you put me between the two main pillars of the house? And the child was naive and did so. And it says the house was full of men and women, and all the lords of the Philistines were there. And there were upon the roof about 3,000 men and women who beheld while Samson made sport. And Samson called unto the Lord and said, O Lord God, remember me, I pray thee, and strengthen me, I pray thee, only this once, O God, that I may be at once avenged of the Philistines for my two eyes. And Samson took hold of the middle two pillars upon which the house stood. There were two. Apparently the architecture was such that the bulk of the weight of the ceiling rested on two primary pillars, which must have been not very far from each other, because he could reach them both at the same time. And it's very possible that he was chained to the pillars so that he could pull them down by pulling rather than pushing. It seems like they'd have to be awfully close together for him to be able to reach, you know, at a strength, you know, to knock them over by just extending his arms. They'd have to, you know, there wouldn't be much room between them if that was the case. But it says, Samson called the Lord and says, give me one more chance to avenge myself with my two eyes on these people. And Samson took hold of the two middle pillars upon which the house stood and on which it was borne up, of the one with his right hand and the other with his left hand. And Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. And he bowed himself with all his might. And the house fell upon the lords and upon all the people that were therein. So the dead which he slew at his death were more than they which he slew at his life. Then his brethren and all the house of his father came down and took him and brought him up and buried him between Zorah and Eshtaol in the burying place of Manoah his father. And he had judged Israel 20 years. Notice, it doesn't even say they mourned him, though they must have, I'm sure. Yet his death is not even given the dignity of any record of his being mourned. It's like he died backslidden, although he probably... I feel like he was, you know... of course, it was just an act of vengeance in the end, but I think he really was looking to the Lord again, and he is remembered in the list of the faithful ones in Hebrews chapter 11 as the man of faith and who was commended for his faith. I believe that we will see Samson in heaven. Though that will be certainly a monument to the grace of God that he is there for his faith, because he failed God so miserably, both morally and ultimately by betraying his special vow. He's the only man we know who took a Nazarite vow or who had...